Hello and welcome. You are listening to From Here with a View, a We Are the Seats Philadelphia podcast. My name is Zachariah Julian. Our producer, Michelle St. John, recently had the honor of visiting with artist Siobhan Brown in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. Siobhan Juanita Brown is a language keeper, actor, writer, director, and educator. She has worked for and within her community as a student and teacher of the Wuppanoc language. Siobhan is currently an adjunct professor at Brown University in the acting program and also serves as director for We Are the Land, a community-devised play that shares the Wampanoag experience. Here now is Siobhan Brown.
Wanikisa knatasuis kisa kuiam. Nutomas masipiet, kahna tai masipiet. Hello, my name is Siobhan, growing elm, and I'm Mashpee Wampanoag, and I live in Mashpee.
How did you come to the arts?
I think as a child, I was always comforted by my own imagination, like my own dream space and creative space. I'm the youngest of four, so there was a lot of time to myself to explore that. And in the third grade, like, you know, most schools at the time in the 70s, November comes along and the teacher is inspired to do a story about the first Thanksgiving. She starts speaking about Wampanoag people and the pilgrims and the whole myth. But I hear about Squanto and I hear about, you know, Wampanoag people, and I just get inspired, excited. And by the end of the production, the play was all about Squanto. I played Squanto, of course. And I just kind of took over the whole thing and, you know, brought in props. My mother made me regalia and just turned the play all around. And I just remember that being the most fulfilling experience, you know, that if we're going to talk about Wampanoag people, I'm going to center them to the best of my ability, to the best of my third grade ability, knowing that the story was just so limited and it was so different from what I was hearing at home, but still it was a time to perform, a chance to perform, and I took it and ran with it. And since that time, anything that had to do with storytelling or acting things out, or, you know, creating a picture for other people to see that didn't involve a book, I was all about it. Once I got to high school, there was a representative from Emerson College who was visiting my school and encouraged me to take part in Emerson's Summer Youth Theater Program, which I ended up doing. And that was the first time that I could really focus all of my thought, time, and energy on doing a play, until it became time to figure out a major for college. And that's when I just said, I'm going to study performing arts. I was able to enroll at Emerson and started out going part-time to save money for tuition, and was able to then transition to being a full-time student. Towards the end, tuition had kept going up and up, so I was then again balancing things, but always looking at performing arts as the center of my life and center of my focus to be able to tell stories in different ways.
And what was the next step in your journey?
You know, Emerson is a big film school as well, film and television. So I took part in some student films, studied dance and singing, but really honed in on acting while I was there. And I was introduced to performing Shakespeare. I had to read Shakespeare in high school for English class. But once I got to college, it never really sat right with me. And after I finished at Emerson, a couple of years after graduation, the American Repertory Theater at Harvard University was recruiting students of color, and in particular students from the area. And I received a phone call from one of my former professors from Emerson saying that they were looking for students of color to audition. So I just went just to, you know, see what it was all about. And when I got to a point in the process, you know, it was clear that I was in the land of Shakespeare and that it was going to be a big part of, in fact, the center of the training. And, you know, at that time, I was pretty transparent about my thoughts and opinions. And I remember filling out a form that just says, you know, to be honest with you all, Shakespeare just really gets on my nerves. It's not something that I enjoy doing. I'm not going to fake the funk here. I'm not going to try and be who you think that I should be. I'm just going to be me. And also, in order to audition, you had to have a personal mission statement. And so that statement, I remember writing, you know, I'm a Black and Wampanoag woman who grew up in the inner city in Boston, went to school in Weston from kindergarten to high school, which is one of the most affluent suburbs in Massachusetts. And I've seen, you know, differences of all kinds. And, you know, there's been some good parts in that upbringing and some bad parts. But as I come to this American repertory theater, does American theater include me? Is it inclusive of a Black Wampanoag young woman like myself? And that was my statement. When I come through the door, essentially, what I was saying was that I'm going to bring my whole self. I'm not going to disguise, you know, who I am just for the sake of theater or doing theater or acceptance of some kind. And I remember being in the audition room, and actually the auditions were held by the voice teacher, because that's who you spend most of your time with. You know, I'd done my audition. It was, you know, my contemporary and my classical piece. And, you know, I was gathering my things, and she just calmly states, "I read your statement." A little bit of silence, and I just go, "Okay." And she goes, "There's not a lot of that around here." And I just turned around and said, "Why not? You know, so you're saying that the theater doesn't represent the population of the country that whose name it's embracing, right?" So it was the start of a very interesting relationship in terms of understanding, you know, one another, in terms of being in an environment that was actively erasing me. There were hardly any teachers of color, particularly at that graduate level. And whenever you spoke about race or diversity, that environment in particular, there was this knee-jerk reaction to look to the global, right? And to say, you know, we're not racist. We do theater from Russia. We do theater from South America. You know, we do theater, you know, from all over the world. While they're sitting on indigenous land, you know, at a university that is actively, you know, withholding important items and artifacts that are important to indigenous people, all these things that are going on at Harvard, who still functions under, you know, the charter that states its purpose being to educate indigenous people, just actively ignoring the purpose and the actual land of where we were, as an artist, just living through that and walking through that every day. At ART really helped to define the artist that I would become, because there wasn't any mentorship of an indigenous, you know, way or of an indigenous of indigeneity at all. And, you know, we are the original storytellers on this land. So that energy wasn't a part of my education, but it was definitely present in everything that I would do. At that time, I would just look at scripts and look at characters, and I would look for moments when I could channel my grandmother's. You know, that isolation just really emboldened my desire to bring more of who I am forward, while being trained to understand that acting is about, you know, shedding. It's about becoming somebody else, when really any true art form grounds you in who you are. And that sort of difference what was happening in me and what was being taught to me at the same time was an interesting constriction. And I'm really grateful to have come out of it alive.
Was there an aha moment that inspired you to use your training in a different way?
There was. It was twofold. It was the voice work that I was doing. I could literally feel first and hear my voice changing in the sense that I wasn't morphing into someone else. I was coming closer to who I actually am. It was kind of a personal goal of mine. It's like, okay, if I'm not going to play characters who are familiar to me or close to my lived experience for 2 years, then I set personal goals for the vocal training and for like how to work with different directors. And the second like real impactful moment was being cast in Susan Laurie Park's The America play. And while I had, you know, done plays before with an all-Black cast, this was a small, close-knit group. And I worked with actors who were out in the field working and working with a playwright that nobody really knew about, who was writing in a way that was musical, was like jazz. And it did have an indigenous feel to it, the rhythm of it and the push and pull and the cadence. So being involved in that piece at that time really helped to give me hope that when I leave this environment, I will have to seek out specific stories, specific writers, specific environments that are culturally supportive.
And were you able to create your own work or find space for your own indigeneity?
Mm-hmm. Right after school, I did move to New York City. You know, again, very isolating. I guess it's one of those if you know, you know kind of thing. The city at that time was morphing into what it is now, where things are just, you know, apartments and cost of living is just really, really high. As far as like connecting with Indigenous theater, it was very difficult at that time, you know, for me stepping into the fullness of my identity and coming to terms with how I was being seen at the time too. You know, I was grateful to have representation. You know, they were sending me out for things that where it was very difficult to actually, you know, book the job. It was a lot of Black drama, which was great, but as a light-skinned woman of color, it wasn't always entirely appropriate for me to play certain parts. And, you know, I would go in knowing that and just try to, you know, focus on the good of the situation, introduce myself. But there were not roles where I knew that this part is me and that I could do this part, particularly early on. And sort of that creative longing for community led me to just volunteer. You know, I went to the Smithsonian down in Battery Park and would volunteer on Saturday afternoons at the Museum of the American Indian. And there, you know, was introduced to the community house and, you know, met members of community where I could, you know, connect and hear about events and hear about gatherings and feel a lot less isolated, you know. And, you know, continuing to show up for auditions, even though it wasn't like fit me like a glove, there was one role that came across my agent's desk that I ended up booking that actually I did have a lot of space to be my whole self. And that really changed things. That was a really nice shift where I could look at this character who actually was African-American, was light-skinned, and was also Indigenous. And, you know, what that meant for the trajectory of the character and the nuances that weren't really considered, you know, a part of a personal life. right? It was considered as like, you know, the societal structure of the time. And it's like, well, that time's not over. It's still going on now. And that was another turning point after moving to the city. You know, there are some roles out there and I just have to seek it out. And that there are stories that need to be told that I have to sit down and do that deep listening and write. At one point, my sister had the wisdom to record our grandmothers whenever they would get to talking, you know, at the kitchen table and stuff. And after a few years, she had a big shoebox filled with recordings from both my grandmother and my Nana. And one day my sister just took them and put them down in front of me and said, do something with this. And at that time, you know, looked at it and was like, what, what are you talking about? Like, what is there to do with, you know, with these voices? And I just sat and listened and transcribed them all and read it through, listened to them over and over again, and just started to hear two of the most influential voices in my life growing up. And you know, their messages to me, and just really sat with that over time, and eventually was able to put together and piece together a one-act play that went through kind of a visit with both Grandma and Nana that turned into a piece that I have called A Piece of Silver. And that, you know, reflects on my relationship with them, my relationship with my mother, their relationship to my mom, some life events that happened through the course of their life, and, you know, looks back in history, and then sort of folds together just kind of that warm embrace that your grandmas give you. And because both were just very outspoken and had full lives, like very dramatic events in their lives. And the fact that they both lived well into their 90s and were telling us stories, they were constantly giving, constantly pouring into us. And to be able to take, you know, the art form that I love so much, to be able to honor them means a lot. So, you know, I hope that they look at it in a good way from where they are.
At some point, did you find an interest in directing?
Yeah, it's something I touched on when I was in school, when I was in undergrad, and I really liked it. You know, I did take a directing class. You know, I did all the cliches, you know, as a young director. And then I think it really comes from loving to move. I love movement. When I was in undergrad, I did a lot with an improvisational movement troupe. You know, we would do a lot of like physical theater. We would work with, you know, different fabrics and different materials and create different environments, you know, just using our bodies. And so I'm always just interested in how we can tell story in multiple ways. And I think that the last couple of years, just having more of an understanding of the impact of stories and how everyone that comes through the door to witness a story comes with their own perception, their own lived experience, but there's something that, you know, rings through the body. There's something that happens when we're all witnessing something at the same time. That kind of shift in focus has kind of come in the last few years. Like, how can our stories be supported by that fact, you know, that we all come to the same story. We're not sitting in our own homes, you know, watching a screen. We're all together, shoulder to shoulder, watching this. And what does that energy do to the room, to the storytellers, to the originators of the story, and specifically to the land? I do believe that the stories are in the land and that they are living and breathing and just waiting for us to embrace them in a way that, you know, can maybe bring about some change and give us a little bit more hope or point us in the right direction on how to take care of this earth and ourselves and each other in a better way than we're doing right now.
Can you talk about how We Are the Land came to be?
Yeah, I always say that I was voluntold to be involved with We Are the Land. But I am super, super grateful for, you know, our elders coming and, you know, asking me to be involved along with the rest of the creative team, you know, Hartman, Kitty, yourself, Linda Coombs. There's just so many, you know, folks who have made this their life work to represent Wampanoag history, people, culture, and life ways in a good way. And, you know, I'm just always humbled whenever I'm in the space with the whole cast. We Are the Land, I guess the initial idea for it started about 10 years ago. And it was a project that, you know, folks wanted to have happen to celebrate and commemorate the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Mayflower on these shores. What I understand is that initially they wanted a big, huge group of Wampanoag people to perform the history of the first arrival, I guess. And there was a script written by a non-Native person. There were devising sessions held here in Mashpee. There were folks invited to come and work with individuals from the Theatre Royal in Plymouth in the UK. And, you know, there was a lot of exchange happening. But at the end of the day, I remember Linda just saying she looked at the script and felt as though they were just repeating history, that they were just coming over here to tell us how we should tell our story, and felt it was important that we tell our own story and that we devise our own piece and, you know, begin from there. There were some meetings in the last year to bring this to fruition. That's when I was asked to join in, and there was sort of a frame that I think Hartman and Kitty worked on to be able to tell a story. And we worked from there to meet. There are 15 members of the cast to come together and basically do devising sessions. Devising is one of my favorite ways of making theater. You know, it involves everybody that's going to be on the stage and involves, you know, listening as an individual, but also as a collective. And that was happening a lot when we moved through the different sections. You know, we begin with pre-contact and we move to, you know, Christianization and colonization. Move to events that happened in the 1600s, the 1700s, 1800s, that are pertinent to Wampanoag people. Important because, you know, we were sort of the portal. This is where it started. This is the blueprint for what happened across Turtle Island. The ways in which there was, you know, division and taking of land and taking of land's resources like trees and then, you know, deforesting and trying to then sell back to Indigenous people what they had access to for free, and eventually establishing a tax base in an area where it's written that we would not form a town without Wampanoag consent and everyone agreeing, but yet that town was established anyway. All of the different movement to control the area and to control Indigenous people, to establish a tax base and to establish, you know, a sense of economy here. And, you know, essentially to wipe us out when we move through each event, through the play, and then come to the end where we can say, you know, we are still here. It speaks to not just to resilience, but to the power of story. You know, it speaks to families educating their children to understand how things are right now and how they were before they got to this place, so that we're not repeating that cycle, so that we can have a presence, we can have our language, we can have connection to our land, so that we can clean up our water, so that we can, you know, leave this place better than we found it. All of those values really come through with We Are the Land and how the cast comes together to tell the story.
As a Wampanoag woman, what does it mean to be able to use your gifts to be able to bring this story to the world?
Really, it means everything. It's really rooted in purpose and, you know, that spiritual connection that art gives us. I know that there's just moments where you feel like, okay, I'm here because I was meant to do this. And it feels a little strange when saying that, but it makes, like, the isolation and the difficult times and the constriction was all towards a purpose. And I feel like it was all towards understanding the difference between rooting, you know, theater training and theater practice through a European lens. The origins of theater, you know, the rest of the world understands it to be Greek. When there are origins right here, there are indigenous storytelling foundations, practices, principles that are right here, that are of a circular nature, that you know, are passed down through oral tradition, and that have a matrilineal focus, and that need that balance of the binary, as opposed to there being one that overpowers the other. And, you know, that speaks to the beauty and power of our culture and of our ways and of our people and our stories. You know, that speaks to the beauty and power of the land under our feet and, you know, coming to the place of really feeling like this is work that you were meant to do. I did not feel that until working on We Are the Land, if I'm being perfectly honest. You know, I may have had glimpses of that, you know, working with other great stories and great writers, but the fullness of working on this piece with everyone who is involved, it's really what has made the most sense. You know, becoming an artist is such a deep personal decision and choice. And, you know, so when one stops doing it, that also is a deep personal choice and, you know, hardship when you feel like, oh, I need to stop doing this. And then when things come to you again, when it's called forward, for me, that's a moment of truth and sincerity in life. And you can't really prescribe that. You can't really say, you know, oh, in 5 years, I'm going to do this, 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 and this. You know, I'm going to do a play with my community and take it to the UK and perform it here on these shores. I think I shared this with the cast. My mother would always, you know, share with me that, you know, when I was a baby, you know, she would put me down on the bed and, you know, just be sitting there looking at me, and she'd get this feeling like, this one's going to do something. Well, first, I think all mothers say that about their children. But I really feel like We Are the Land is what my mother was sort of feeling at that moment, because, you know, I've been in some spaces, I've done some things, but nothing really brings it all together. Identity, wholeness, connection to place, connection to community, and to be able to bring to the surface things that have actively been suppressed. You know, it takes a lot for us to be able to tell our own story and to be able to do it in a safe environment and to be able to do it in a way that speaks to everyone. And I feel like this piece really accomplishes that. And I'm just super grateful for it and grateful to be in the circle with everybody.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Siobhan. Katapatash.
It's my pleasure. Katapatash.
Ihe'en, Siobhan Brown. My name is Zachariah Julian. And thank you for joining us for this episode of From Here with a View.
From Here with a View, a We Are the Seeds Philadelphia podcast is produced by Michelle St. John, with music by Zachariah Julian and original logo art by Jason Misong. This podcast is funded in part by Independence Public Media Foundation. For more information, please visit wearetheseeds.org.